Young as you are, Theaetetus, are you teaching your elders to do wrong by breaking their agreements? Get ready instead to give Socrates an account of what's left.
Yes, if he's willing, but I'd love nothing better than to hear about the things I'm asking about.
You're calling Socrates to a cavalry battle on open ground by inviting him into this discussion. Ask your questions then, and you'll hear.
But I don't think, Theodorus, that on the matters Theaetetus is urging I'll do as he asks.
Why won't you?
Melissus and the others who say the whole is one and at rest, I'm not too embarrassed to examine them, for fear of seeming crude, less embarrassed than I am about one man alone, Parmenides. Parmenides seems to me, in Homer's phrase, both an object of reverence and one to be feared. I met the man when I was quite young and he quite old, and he struck me as having a depth that was altogether noble. So I'm afraid we may not even grasp what was said, and fall far short of what he meant when he said it, and worst of all, that the very question for whose sake the argument was set going, what knowledge actually is, may go unexamined, buried under all the arguments crashing in on us uninvited, if we let ourselves be swept along by them. Especially since the question we're now stirring up is itself immense. If one treats it as a side issue, it will get unworthy treatment, and if one treats it properly, being drawn out at length, it will bury the question of knowledge out of sight. Neither should happen. Instead, we should try, using our art of midwifery, to deliver Theaetetus of what he's carrying about knowledge.
Well, if that's your judgment, that's what we should do.
Now then, Theaetetus, consider this further point about what's been said. You answered that knowledge is perception, right?
Yes.
So if someone asked you this, by what does a person see white and black things, and by what does he hear high and low sounds? You'd say, I imagine, by the eyes and the ears.
I would.
Being easy about words and phrases and not scrutinizing them too closely is usually not a mark of bad breeding. Quite the opposite is rather ungenerous, but sometimes it's necessary, and this is one of those times when we have to take hold of the answer you gave, insofar as it isn't right. Consider, which answer is more correct, that the eyes are that by which we see, or that through which we see, and that the ears are that by which we hear, or that through which we hear?
I think it's more correct to say we perceive through them rather than by them, Socrates.
Yes, for it would be strange, my boy, if a number of perceptions were sitting inside us as if in wooden horses, rather than all of them converging on some single form, call it soul, or whatever one should call it, by which, through these as instruments, so to speak, we perceive whatever is perceivable.
Yes, that seems more likely to me than the other way.
The reason I'm being so precise about this is to find out whether it's by someone and the same thing in us that we reach whites and blacks through the eyes and other things again through the other senses, and whether, if asked, you'll be able to refer all such cases back to the body. But perhaps it's better for you to answer and say these things yourself, rather than have me busy myself on your behalf. Tell me, hot and hard and light and sweet things, which you perceive through the body, don't you assign each of them to the body? Or to something else?
To nothing else.
And will you also be willing to agree that what you perceive through one faculty, it's impossible to perceive through another? What you perceive through hearing, say, through sight, or what you perceive through sight, through hearing?
Of course I'll agree to that.
So if you have some thought about both of them together, you couldn't be perceiving something common to both through either one of the two organs alone.
No, indeed.
Now take sound and color. First, do you think this very thing about both of them, that they both exist?
I do.
And also that each is different from the other, but the same as itself?
Of course.
And that the two together are two, and each one is one.
That too.
And are you also able to consider whether the two are unlike each other, or alike?
Perhaps.
Now through what do you think all these things about the pair? Neither through hearing nor through sight can one grasp what's common to them. Here's further evidence for what we're saying. If it were possible to examine whether the two of them are salty or not, you know you'd be able to say by what you'd examine it, and it plainly isn't sight or hearing, but something else.
Of course, the power that works through the tongue.
Well put. But through what does the power work that reveals to you what's common to all things, including these, the very thing you're naming when you say is, and is not, and the other things we were just now asking about them? What organs will you assign for all these, through which the perceiving part of us perceives each of them?
You mean being and not being, and likeness and unlikeness, and sameness and difference, and also oneness and numbers in general as applied to them. And clearly you're also asking through what bodily organ we perceive, with the soul, even and odd, and everything else that goes along with these.
You're following superbly, Theaetetus, and these are exactly the things I'm asking about.
But by Zeus, Socrates, I couldn't say, except that it seems to me there's no special organ at all for these, the way there is for those other things. Rather, the soul itself, through itself, seems to me to survey what's common to everything.
You're a handsome man, Theaetetus, and not, as Theodorus said, ugly, for whoever speaks handsomely is both handsome and good. And besides being handsome, you've done me a great favor by freeing me from a very long argument, if it appears to you that the soul examines some things by itself, through itself, and others through the powers of the body. For that was exactly what I myself thought, and I wanted you to think it too.
Well, it certainly does appear that way.
To which class, then, do you assign being? For that above all attaches to everything.
I'd put it among the things the soul itself reaches for by itself.
And likeness too, and unlikeness, and sameness and difference.
Yes.
What about the beautiful and the ugly, the good and the bad?
These two, it seems to me, are among the things whose being the soul examines most of all by comparing them with each other, reckoning within itself things past and present against things to come.
Hold on. Won't it perceive the hardness of something hard through touch, and likewise the softness of something soft?
Yes.
But their being, and that they both exist, and their opposition to each other, and again the being of that opposition, these the soul itself tries to determine for us by going back over them and comparing them with one another.
Certainly.
So some things are there for humans and animals alike to perceive by nature. The moment they're born, whatever experiences reach the soul through the body, while the reckonings about these, concerning their being and their usefulness, come only with difficulty and over time, through much trouble and education, to those to whom they come at all.
Absolutely.
Is it possible, then, to attain truth where one doesn't even attain being?
Impossible.
And will someone who misses the truth of a thing ever have knowledge of it?
How could he, Socrates?
Then knowledge lies not in the experiences themselves, but in the reasoning about them. For it's there, it seems, that one can grasp being and truth, but not there in the experiences.
So it appears.
Do you really call those two the same thing, then, when they differ so greatly?
That certainly wouldn't be right.
Then what name do you give to the other one, seeing, hearing, smelling, feeling cold, feeling hot?
Perceiving, what else would I call it?
So you call the whole of it together perception?
It must be so.
Something, we're saying, that has no share in reaching truth, since it has none in reaching being.
No, it doesn't.
Nor then in knowledge.
No.
Then perception and knowledge, Theaetetus, could never be the same thing.
It doesn't look like it, Socrates. And now, more than ever, it's become perfectly clear that knowledge is something other than perception.
But surely this was never the point of our conversation, to find what knowledge is not, but what it is. Still, we've made this much progress. We no longer look for it in perception at all, but in whatever it is the soul is called when it goes to work by itself on the things that are.
But surely that's called forming a judgment, Socrates, or so I think.
You think rightly, my friend. Now look again from the beginning, wiping away everything said before, and see whether you can see more clearly now that you've come this far. Tell me again what knowledge is.
It's impossible to say it's judgment in general, Socrates, since judgment can also be false. But true judgment is probably knowledge, and let that be my answer. If it doesn't hold up as we go further, as it's holding up right now, we'll try to say something else.
That's the spirit, Theaetetus. Better to answer boldly than to hesitate the way you did at first. If we go on like this, one of two things will happen. Either we'll find what we're after, or we'll be less inclined to think we know what we don't know at all, and that would be no shabby reward. So tell me now, there being two kinds of judgment, one true and the other false, do you define knowledge as the true judgment?
I do, that's how it looks to me now.
Then is it still worth going back over judgment?
Which part do you mean?
Something has been troubling me, now and many times before, so that I've been at a total loss with myself and with others, unable to say what this experience is in us and how it comes about.
Which experience?
Judging something falsely. I'm looking at it right now, still uncertain whether we should leave it be or examine it some other way than we just did.
Why not, Socrates, if it really seems necessary? Just now you and Theodorus were saying, quite rightly, that in matters like these there's no need to rush.
A fair reminder. Perhaps it isn't a bad time to pick up the trail again. Better to finish a small thing well than a large one inadequately.
Quite so.
Well then, what exactly are we saying? We say that judgment is sometimes false, and that one of us judges falsely while another judges truly, as though that were simply how things are by nature.
Yes, that's what we say.
Now isn't this true for us about everything, taken one by one? Either we know it or we don't know it. I'll set aside learning and forgetting as things that happen in between. They're irrelevant to our argument right now.
But surely, Socrates, nothing else is left concerning any given thing except knowing it or not knowing it.
Then isn't it already necessary that anyone who judges is judging about something he either knows or doesn't know?
Necessary.
And it's impossible for someone who knows a thing not to know that very thing, or for someone who doesn't know it to know it.
Of course.
So does the person who judges falsely take things he knows and think they're not those things but some other things he knows, so that, knowing both, he's somehow ignorant of both at once.
That's impossible, Socrates.
But perhaps he takes things he doesn't know to be other things he doesn't know, so that someone who knows neither Theaetetus nor Socrates could get it into his head that Socrates is Theaetetus, or Theaetetus is Socrates.
How could he?
But surely no, one takes things he knows to be things he doesn't know, nor things he doesn't know to be things he does know.
That would be a monstrosity.
Then how could anyone still judge falsely? Outside these possibilities, there's no way to judge at all, since everything falls under either knowing or not knowing, and within these, it appears nowhere possible to judge falsely.
Very true.
So shouldn't we look at what we're after not in terms of knowing and not knowing, but in terms of being and not being?
What do you mean?
Maybe it's simply this. Whoever judges what is not about anything at all cannot help but judge falsely, whatever state his mind happens to be in otherwise.
That sounds likely too, Socrates.
Well then, what shall we say, Theaetetus, if someone presses us on this? Is it possible for anyone, and will any human being ever judge what is not, whether about something that is or all by itself? And it seems we'll answer, yes, whenever he believes something untrue while believing it, or how shall we put it?
That way.
Does the same sort of thing happen anywhere else?
Which sort?
If someone sees something but sees nothing.
How could that be?
But surely if he sees some one thing, he sees something that is. Or do you think the number one can ever belong among things that are not?
I don't.
So whoever sees some one thing sees something that is.
So it appears.
And whoever hears something hears some one thing, and hears something that is.
Yes.
And whoever touches something touches some one thing, and something that is, if indeed it's one thing.
That too.
And doesn't whoever judges judge some one thing?
Necessarily.
And whoever judges some one thing judges something that is.
I grant it.
So whoever judges what is not judges nothing.
So it appears.
But surely, whoever judges nothing isn't judging at all.
That seems clear.
Then it's not possible to judge what is not, either about things that are or all by itself.
It doesn't appear so.
Then judging falsely must be something different from judging things that are not.
It seems different.
So neither this way, nor the way we examined it a little earlier, is false judgment present in us.
No, it isn't.
But is this perhaps what we mean when we name it?
How so?
We say false judgment is a kind of cross-judging, when someone, exchanging one thing that is for another thing that is, declares in his mind that it is that other thing. In this way, he always judges something that is, but one thing instead of another, and since he misses the very thing he was aiming at, he could rightly be called someone judging falsely.
Now you seem to me to have put it exactly right. When someone judges the ugly to be beautiful, or the beautiful to be ugly, that's truly judging falsely.
Clearly, Theaetetus, you're feeling bold with me rather than cautious.
Why do you say that?
I don't think you'd let me get hold of true falsehood if I asked whether it's possible for something quick to become slow or something light to become heavy in accordance with the nature of its opposite rather than its own, becoming, that is, the opposite of itself. Well, I'll let that go so you don't get bold for nothing. But do you stand by this, that judging falsely is cross-judging?
I do.
So on your view, it's possible to set one thing down in the mind as another, and not as that very thing itself.
It is indeed.
Then whenever someone's mind does this, isn't it necessary that it's thinking of both things or one of them?
Necessary either both together or one at a time.
Excellent. And do you mean by thinking what I mean?
What do you mean by it?
A discourse the soul carries on with itself about whatever it's examining. I'm telling you this as someone who doesn't really know, mind you. But this is how it appears to me. When the soul thinks, it's doing nothing but conversing, asking itself questions and answering them, affirming and denying. And when it has settled the matter, whether slowly or in a quick leap, and says the same thing at last without wavering, that's what we call its judgment. So for my part, I call judging speaking and judgment speech that has been spoken, not aloud to someone else, but silently to oneself. What about you?
I agree.
So whenever someone judges one thing to be another, he's saying to himself, it seems, that the one thing is the other.
Of course.
Try to recall, then, whether you've ever said to yourself that the beautiful is, in fact, ugly, or the unjust just. Or, to put the whole matter in one question, consider whether you've ever tried to convince yourself that one thing simply is another, or, on the contrary, whether even in a dream you've ever dared to say to yourself that odd numbers are, without qualification, even, or anything of that sort.
What you say is true.
And do you think anyone else, sane or mad, would ever dare to tell himself in earnest, trying to persuade himself, that an ox must be a horse, or that two must be one?
No, by Zeus, not I.
So if speaking to oneself is judging, then no one who says both things and judges both, grasping both in his soul, would say and judge that the one is the other. And you too must let go of that phrase, the other. I mean by it that no one judges the ugly to be beautiful, or anything of that kind.
Well, Socrates, I do let it go, and I think you're right.
Then someone thinking of both things at once can't possibly judge the one to be the other.
So it seems.
But then again, someone thinking only of the one and not at all of the other will never judge the one to be the other either.
True, for that would require him to grasp even what he isn't thinking of.
So neither thinking of both nor thinking of one alone leaves room for cross-judging. So if anyone means by false judgment this cross-judging, he's saying nothing, for false judgment turns out to be present in us neither this way nor in the way we examined before.
It doesn't seem so.
And yet, Theaetetus, if this turns out not to exist, we'll be forced to admit a great many strange things.
Such as what?
I won't tell you until I've tried looking at it from every angle. I'd be ashamed on our behalf if, stuck as we are, we were forced to admit the sorts of things I have in mind. But if we find a way through and get free, then we can speak about others caught in that predicament, standing clear of the absurdity ourselves. But if we're stuck everywhere, then, humbled, I suppose we'll hand ourselves over to the argument to be trampled and used however it likes, the way seasick men are. So listen to how I still see a possible path through this inquiry.
Just tell me.
I'll say we were wrong to agree, when we agreed that it's impossible for someone to judge things he doesn't know to be the very things he does know, and so be deceived. It's actually possible in a way.
Do you mean what I suspected myself back when we first said it was like that, that sometimes I, knowing Socrates, but seeing someone else at a distance whom I don't know, thought he was the Socrates I know? Something like what you're describing does happen.
And didn't we back away from that idea because it made us, who knew things, not know them?
Quite so.
Then let's not set it up that way, but this way. Maybe it will agree with us on some point, maybe it will resist, but we're caught in a place where we must test the argument by turning it every way. So see whether there's anything in this. Is it possible for someone who doesn't yet know a thing to come to learn it later?
It is indeed.
And again, one thing after another.
Why not?
Now suppose, just for the sake of argument, that there's a block of wax lodged in our souls, larger in one person, smaller in another, of purer wax in one, dirtier in another, harder in some, softer in others, and in some of just the right consistency.
I'll suppose it.
Let's say it's a gift from memory, mother of the muses, and that whenever we want to remember something we've seen or heard or thought up ourselves, we hold this wax under our perceptions and thoughts and stamp them into it, the way we press the design of a signet ring. And whatever gets stamped, we remember and know as long as the image remains in it. But whatever gets wiped away, or can't be stamped in the first place, we've forgotten and don't know.
Let it be so.
Now take someone who knows these things but is looking at something he sees or hears, and consider whether he might judge falsely in some such way as this.
In what way, exactly?
By thinking that things he knows are, at one moment, things he knows, and at another, things he doesn't know. For we were wrong earlier to agree that this was impossible.
And how do you put it now?
We need to state the whole thing from the beginning by drawing distinctions. It's impossible for someone to take something he knows, holding a record of it in his soul, but not perceiving it, and believe it to be something else he knows, something for which he also holds an imprint, but which he isn't perceiving either. And again, it's impossible to believe that something he knows is something he doesn't know, and has no seal of it all, or that something he doesn't know is something else he doesn't know, or that something he doesn't know is something he does know. And it's impossible to believe that something he's perceiving is something else he's perceiving, or that something he's perceiving is one of the things he isn't perceiving, or that something he isn't perceiving is one of the things he isn't perceiving, or that something he isn't perceiving is something he is perceiving. And further still, and this is even more impossible than those, if that's even possible to believe that something he both knows and perceives, and for which he holds the mark that matches the perception, is something else that he also knows and perceives, and for which he also holds a matching mark. And when someone holds the record correctly for both what he knows and what he perceives, it's impossible for him to believe that what he knows is something he perceives in a way that doesn't match. And it's impossible that what he doesn't know and doesn't perceive is what he doesn't know and doesn't perceive. And impossible that what he neither knows nor perceives is what he doesn't know. And impossible that what he neither knows nor perceives is what he doesn't perceive. All these cases are beyond the reach of anyone forming a false belief within them. So what's left is that if false belief can arise anywhere, it's among cases of this last sort.
Which sort? Maybe I'll understand better if you give me an example right now I'm not following.
Among things a person knows, he believes them to be some other things that he knows and perceives, or things he doesn't know but perceives, or among things he knows and perceives, that they're other things he also knows and perceives.
Now I'm even further behind than before.
Then listen to it the other way around. I know Theodorus, and I have a memory in myself of what he's like, and the same with Theaetetus. Now, don't I sometimes see them and sometimes not, sometimes touch them and sometimes not, sometimes hear them or otherwise perceive them, and at other times have no perception of you two at all, yet remember you no less and know you within myself?
Absolutely.
So here's the first thing I want you to grasp from what I'm saying. It's possible not to be perceiving something one knows, and it's also possible to be perceiving it.
Drill.
And with things one doesn't know, isn't it often possible neither to perceive them, and often possible only to perceive them?
That's possible too.
Now see if you follow a bit better now. Suppose Socrates knows Theodorus and Theaetetus, but sees neither of them, and has no other perception of them present to him, he could never form the inner belief that Theaetetus is Theodorus. Am I saying something or nothing?
Yes, something true.
Well, that was the first of the cases I mentioned.
It was.
Second then, knowing one of you but not the other, and perceiving neither, I could never believe that the one I know is the one I don't know.
Right.
And third, knowing neither of you and perceiving neither, I couldn't believe that the one I don't know is some other one I don't know. And take it that you've heard again, in order, all the earlier cases, in none of them will I ever form a false belief about you and Theodorus, whether I know both of you or am ignorant of both, or know one and not the other. And the same holds for perceptions, if you're following.
I'm following.
So what's left is for false belief to occur in this case. When I know both you and Theodorus, and hold in that block of wax, the marks of both of you like the impressions of signet rings, but seeing you both from far off and not clearly enough, I try to assign each mark to its proper appearance, fitting it into its own track so that recognition happens, and then I miss. And like people putting shoes on the wrong feet, I cross the marks and apply each person's appearance to the mark that belongs to the other. Or the way sight behaves in mirrors, when right flows over to left, I suffer the same sort of thing and go wrong. It's then that the crossing of beliefs happens and false believing.
Yes, it does seem so, Socrates. It's remarkable how you describe what happens with belief.
And further, when I know both of you, and I'm perceiving one of you along with knowing him, but not the other, and my knowledge of that other one doesn't match his perception, this is what I meant earlier, and you didn't follow me then.
No, I didn't.
What I meant was this. When I know one of you and perceive him, and my knowledge of him matches the perception, I'll never believe he's some other person whom I both know and perceive, and for whom my knowledge in turn matches the perception. Wasn't that it?
Yes.
What was left out, though, is the case we're speaking of now, the one where we say false belief arises. Knowing both and seeing both, or having some other perception of both, but not holding each mark matched to its own perception, rather like an unskilled archer who lets fly and misses the mark wide, going astray. And that, indeed, is exactly what has been named falsehood.
With good reason.
And also when perception of the marks is present to one of them, but not the other, and the mind fits the missing perception onto the one that's present in every such case, the mind goes false. In short, about things a person neither knows nor has ever perceived, it seems there can be no falsehood and no false belief at all, if what we're saying now is sound. But about things we do know and perceive, it's right there, in those very things, that belief turns and twists, becoming false or true, true when it draws together the matching impressions and imprints straight on and directly, false when it goes off at a slant, askew.
Isn't that well put, Socrates?
You'll say so even more once you hear this too. Believing what's true is admirable, and being deceived is shameful.
Of course.
Well, they say this is where it comes from. When the wax in someone's soul is deep and plentiful and smooth and worked to just the right softness, then the things that come in through the senses, stamped onto this heart of the soul, as Homer called it, hinting at its likeness to wax, leave marks in it that are clear and have enough depth, so they last a long time. People like this are, first of all, quick learners, and then retentive. They don't shuffle the marks of their perceptions around, but form true beliefs. Since the marks are distinct and set out with plenty of room, such people quickly sort each one onto its own stamp, the things we call the things that are, and they're, the ones called wise. Or don't you agree?
Enormously so.
But when someone's heart is shaggy, the very thing that always poet praised, or when the wax is impure and full of grime, or too moist or too hard, then those with moist wax are quick to learn but forgetful, while those with hard wax are the opposite. And those whose hearts are shaggy and rough, full of stony grit or clay or dung mixed in, get blurred impressions. Blurred, too, are those whose wax is hard, since there's no depth to it, and blurred also are those whose wax is moist, since the marks quickly run together and become faint. And if, on top of all this, the marks are piled on top of one another for lack of room, because someone's little soul is cramped, they're even more blurred than the others. All these people are the sort prone to false belief. For when they see or hear or think of something, they can't quickly assign each thing to its proper place. They're slow, and they misappropriate what belongs to others, and they see wrong, hear wrong, and think wrong about a great many things. And these people, in turn, are called mistaken about the things that are, and ignorant.
What you say couldn't be more right, Socrates.
So should we say that false beliefs exist in us?
Very much so.
And true ones, too.
True ones, too.
So now we think we've adequately agreed that both these kinds of beliefs certainly exist.
Overwhelmingly so.
It really is a fearsome and unpleasant thing, Theaetetus, to be a man who talks too much, so it seems.
What do you mean, why say that?
I'm annoyed at my own slowness to learn, and, frankly, at my own long-windedness. What else would one call it, when a person drags arguments up and down because he's too sluggish to be persuaded and can't tear himself away from any single argument?
But why are you annoyed?
I'm not just annoyed, I'm afraid of what I'll answer if someone asks me. So, Socrates, have you discovered false belief, that it exists neither within the perceptions in relation to each other, nor within the thoughts, but in the joining of perception to thought? And I imagine I'll say yes, preening myself as if we discovered something fine.
It seems to me, Socrates, that what's just been shown isn't shameful at all.
So, he'll say, you mean that a person, thinking only of a man not seeing him, would never believe him to be a horse, something he neither sees nor touches, but only thinks of with no other perception of it at all? I think that's what I'll say he means.
And rightly so.
Well then, he'll say, take the number 11, when someone is merely thinking of it and nothing else couldn't he, by this same argument, believe that it's 12, when 12 too is something he's only thinking of. Come now, you answer.
Well, I'll answer that someone who's seeing or touching 11 things might believe they're 12, but as for the 11 he holds purely in thought, he could never form that belief about them.
Well then, do you think anyone has ever, within himself, taken 5 and 7? And I don't mean setting out 7 men and 5 men to consider, or anything like that, but 5 itself and 7 itself. The very things we say are recorded as imprints in that wax block. Things about which we say false belief is impossible. Has anyone among men ever actually examined these very things, asking himself how many they come to? And has one person said, believing them to be 11, while another said 12, or do all people alike say and believe they come to 12?
No, by Zeus, plenty of people say 11, and if you take a larger number to examine, the error is even more likely. I take it you mean this to apply to any number whatsoever.
You're right to take it that way, and consider whether what happens then is anything other than believing that the very 12 in the wax block is 11.
It does seem so.
So doesn't this bring us back again to our earlier arguments? Whoever undergoes this takes something he knows to be some other thing that he in turn knows which we said was impossible, and it was precisely on this basis that we were forcing false belief not to exist, so that the same person wouldn't be compelled at once to know and not know the same things.
Very true.
So we have to show that believing falsely is something other than a mismatch between thought and perception. For if that's what it were, we'd never be deceived within our thoughts themselves. But as things stand, either there's no such thing as false belief, or it's possible to not know something one knows. Which of these do you choose?
You're offering me an impossible choice, Socrates.
And yet the argument does seem likely to rule out both at once. Still, since we must be bold about everything, what if we tried being shameless?
How so?
By being willing to say what sort of thing knowing actually is.
And what's shameless about that?
You don't seem to realize that this whole discussion of ours from the start has been a search for knowledge, on the grounds that we don't know what it is.
I do realize it.
Then doesn't it seem shameless to declare what knowing is like when we don't yet know what knowledge is? But the truth is, Theaetetus, we've long since been thoroughly unable to converse in a clean way. Countless times we've said we recognize and we don't recognize, we know and we don't know, as if we understood each other while we're still ignorant of knowledge itself. And even now, if you like, in what we've just said, we've again made use of being ignorant and understanding, as if it were proper to use these words while we're deprived of knowledge.
But then how will you carry on the discussion, Socrates, avoiding those words?
No one being who I am, though if that man skilled in refutation were here now, he'd say to steer clear of talk like this, and he'd scold us sharply for what I'm about to say. But since we're only ordinary men, do you want me to be bold and say what understanding is? It seems to me it might get us somewhere.
Be bold then, by Zeus. You'll be forgiven plenty for not steering clear of it.
Have you heard what people nowadays say understanding is?
Maybe, but I don't recall it just now.
They say it's a having of knowledge, I believe.
Drill.
Let's shift the wording slightly then, and say it's a possessing of knowledge.
How would you say that differs from the other?
Maybe not at all, but hear what I think and judge along with me.
As long as I'm able to.
Well, having doesn't seem to me the same thing as possessing. Take a cloak. If someone buys one and has it in his power but isn't wearing it, we'd say he doesn't have it, though we'd say he possesses it.
Rightly put.
Now consider whether it's possible to possess knowledge in that way without having it. Say, if a man caught wild birds, doves, or something else, and built himself a dovecote at home to keep them in, we might say he has them in a sense at all times since he's got them. Right.
Yes.
But in another sense, he has none of them at all. Rather, a power over them has come to be his, now that he's brought them under his control inside an enclosure of his own. The power to take hold of and grasp anyone he wants, whenever he wants, catching whichever he chooses, and to let it go again, and to do this as often as he likes.
That's so.
Once more, then, just as before we built some sort of waxen thing, whatever that odd device was in people's souls, let's now make in each soul a kind of dovecote holding birds of every kind. Some in flocks apart from the rest, some in small groups, others alone here and there, flying about the whole space however they happen to.
All right, it's made. What comes next?
We should say that while we're children, this container is empty, and instead of birds, think of pieces of knowledge. And whenever a man gets hold of some piece of knowledge and shuts it up inside the enclosure, we say he's learned or discovered the thing that knowledge is of, and that this is what understanding is.
Let's grant it.
Now consider what words are needed for going back and catching whichever piece of knowledge he wants, taking hold of it and having it, and then letting it go again, whether the same words as when he first acquired it or different ones. You'll see more clearly what I mean from this. You speak of an art of arithmetic.
Yes.
Take that to be a hunt for pieces of knowledge of everything even and odd.
I take it so.
By means of this art, I think, a man both has the pieces of knowledge of numbers under his own control and hands them over to another when he teaches.
Yes.
And we call the one handing them over a teacher, the one receiving them a learner, and the one who has them by possessing them in that dovecote, one who understands.
Absolutely.
Now pay attention to what follows from this. A man who's a complete arithmetician, does he understand all numbers in some other sense? For he has within his soul pieces of knowledge of all numbers.
Of course.
Could such a man, then, ever count anything, either the numbers themselves to himself, or some external thing that has a number?
Of course he could.
But we'll take counting to be nothing other than examining how great some given number happens to be.
That's so.
So it turns out that what he understands, he appears, in examining it, not to know. This very thing we agreed he knows as every number there is. You've heard such puzzles raised, I suppose.
I have.
Well then, drawing our comparison from the acquiring and hunting of doves, we'll say the hunt was of two kinds. One before possessing them, for the sake of possessing them. The other, once possessed, for the sake of taking hold of and having in one's hands what one had possessed all along. In the same way, things a man already had pieces of knowledge of long ago, and knew, can be learned over again by taking up and grasping the knowledge of each of them anew, knowledge he'd possessed for a long time but didn't have ready at hand in his mind.
Drill.
This is just what I was asking a moment ago, what words one ought to use in speaking of these things, when the arithmetician sets out to count, or the grammarian to read something. Does he, though he understands, go again as one who will learn from himself what he already understands?
But that's absurd, Socrates.
Well then, shall we say instead that he'll read and count things he doesn't understand, granting that he understands every letter and every number?
But that too is unreasonable.
Do you want us to say, then, that we don't care at all about the words, whichever way someone likes to stretch, understand, and learn? But since we've drawn a distinction between possessing knowledge and having it, we say it's impossible not to possess what one has acquired, so that it never happens that a man doesn't know what he knows, though it is possible for him to get a false judgment about it. For it's possible for him not to have that piece of knowledge, but another instead of it. Whenever, in hunting for some piece of knowledge among those flying about, he misses and grabs one instead of another, and then he thinks 11 is 12, having taken hold of the knowledge of 11 instead of that of 12, the one inside himself, as it were a wood pigeon instead of a dove.
Well, that makes sense.
But when he grabs the one he's trying to grab, then he isn't deceived and judges the things that are, and so there is both true and false judgment, and none of the things that troubled us before stands in the way any longer. Perhaps you'll agree with me, or how will you take it?
That way.
Yes, for we've gotten rid of the problem of a man not understanding what he understands. Since it no longer happens anywhere that we fail to possess what we've possessed, whether we've been deceived about something or not. Still, another and more troubling difficulty seems to me to be showing itself.
Which one?
If the exchange of pieces of knowledge for one another should ever turn out to be a false judgment.
How do you mean?
First, that a man who has knowledge of something should be ignorant of that very thing, not through lack of understanding, but by means of his own knowledge, and then that he should judge this thing to be that other thing, and that other thing to be this one. It a great absurdity that, when knowledge is present, the soul should know nothing and be ignorant of everything. By this reasoning, nothing prevents ignorance, when present, from making someone know something, and blindness from making someone see, if indeed knowledge is going to make someone ignorant of something at some point.
Perhaps, Socrates, we didn't set up the birds well by putting only pieces of knowledge among them. We should also have put pieces of ignorance flying about together with them in the soul, and had the hunter sometimes catching a piece of knowledge, sometimes a piece of ignorance about the same thing, judging falsely by means of the ignorance and truly by means of the knowledge.
It's not easy, Theaetetus, not to praise you, but look again at what you just said. Let it be as you say. The man who's caught the ignorance, you say, will judge falsely. Right?
Yes.
But surely, he won't also think that he's judging falsely.
How could he?
No, he'll think he's judging truly, and he'll be disposed as one who knows regarding the very things about which he's been deceived.
Of course.
So he'll suppose he has, by his hunting, knowledge, not ignorance.
Clearly.
So after going a long way round, we're back again at the very first difficulty. That man skilled in refutation will laugh and say, best of men, does someone who knows both of them, knowledge and ignorance, suppose that one of them which he knows is some other one of the things he knows? Or, knowing neither of them, does he suppose that one thing he doesn't know is some other thing he doesn't know? Or, knowing one but not the other, does he suppose the one he knows is the one he doesn't know? Or the one he doesn't know is the one he knows? Or will you tell me again that of the pieces of knowledge and ignorance there are in turn further pieces of knowledge, which their possessor has shut up in some other ridiculous dovecotes or waxen molds, and understands as long as he possesses them, even if he doesn't have them ready at hand in his soul? And so you'll be forced to run round and round to the very same point, over and over, getting nowhere. What shall we answer to this, Theaetetus?
But by Zeus, Socrates, I really don't know what to say.
Then is the argument right, my boy, to rebuke us, and to show that we're wrong to look for false judgment before understanding, setting the latter aside. It's impossible to know the one until someone has adequately grasped what understanding itself is.
As things stand, Socrates, one has to think as you say.
Well then, what will someone say understanding is, starting over again from the beginning? For surely we're not going to give up just yet.
Not at all unless you yourself give up.
Tell me then, what could we say it is that would least contradict ourselves?
What we were trying before, Socrates, I have nothing else to offer.
What was that?
That true judgment is understanding. Judging truly is surely free of error, and everything that comes of it turns out fine and good.
The man leading the way across the river, Theaetetus, said he'd show it to us. And if we go on and search this out, maybe the thing itself, in getting in our way, will reveal what we're looking for. Whereas if we stand still, nothing will become clear.
You're right, let's go on and look.
Well, this much at least needs little examination. A whole art shows you that this can't be understanding.
How so, which art?
The art of those reckoned greatest in wisdom, the ones called orators and pleaders in the courts. These men, by their own art, persuade people not by teaching them, but by making them judge whatever they want them to judge. Or do you think there are teachers so clever that, for people who weren't present to see money being stolen from someone, or some other act of violence, they can teach the truth of what happened well enough in the short time allowed at the water clock?
Not at all, I think, only persuade them.
And by persuading, you mean making them judge something?
Of course.
So whenever jurors are rightly persuaded about matters that can only be known by having seen them, and not otherwise, and in judging these from hearsay they arrive at a true judgment, they've judged without understanding, even if they've been rightly persuaded, granted that they judged well.
Quite so.
But my friend, if true judgment and understanding were the same thing, not even the finest juror would ever judge rightly without understanding. As it is, it seems the two are different things.
There's something, Socrates, that I heard someone say once and had forgotten, but I recall it now. He said that true judgment together with an account is understanding, while true judgment without an account falls outside understanding, and things of which there is no account are not objects of understanding, calling them that, while those that have one are objects of understanding.
Well said. But tell me how he divided up these objects of understanding, and those that aren't, so we can see whether you and I have heard the same account.
But I'm not sure I can work it out, though if someone else told it, I think I could follow along.
Listen, then, to a dream in exchange for a dream. I too seem to hear from certain people that the primary things, so to speak, elements out of which we and everything else are composed, admit of no account. Each thing by itself, on this view, could only be named, nothing further could be said of it, neither that it is nor that it is not. To say that would already be to attach being or non-being to it, and nothing at all must be added if one is going to speak of that thing alone. Indeed, not even the words itself. That, each, alone, or this may be added, nor many other such words, for these go running around attaching themselves to everything, and are different from the things to which they are attached. Whereas if it were possible to state the thing itself, and it had an account proper to it, it would have to be stated apart from all the others. But as things stand, it is impossible for any of the primary elements to be expressed in an account at all, for it has nothing but a name. That is all it has. But the things composed out of these elements, just as the elements themselves are woven together, so their names, woven together, become a statement. For the essence of a statement, on this view, is the weaving together of names. So it turns out that the elements are without account and unknowable, though perceivable, while the syllables are knowable and expressible and can be grasped by true judgment. So then, when someone grasps the true judgment about something without an account, his soul is in a state of truth about it. But he does not know it, for whoever cannot give and receive an account of a thing has no knowledge of it. But once he has acquired an account, he becomes capable of all this and is fully equipped for knowledge. Is this the dream as you heard it, or something else?
Exactly this in every respect.
Are you satisfied then, and do you hold to this, that knowledge is true judgment joined with an account?
I certainly am.
Can it be, Theaetetus, that today, On this very day, we have laid hold of something that many wise men before us went gray searching for and never found.
At any rate, it seems to me, Socrates, that what has just been said is well put.
And it is likely that this very point is so, for what could knowledge even be, apart from an account and correct judgment? Yet there is one thing in what has been said that does not sit well with me.
What is that?
The very point that seems to be put most cleverly, that the elements are unknowable while the class of syllables is knowable.
And isn't that right?
We must find out. We have, after all, hostages for this account, the examples the man used when he said all this.
What examples?
The elements and syllables of the alphabet. Or do you think the one who said what we're describing had his eye on anything else when he said it?
No, on exactly this.
Let us test them then by going back over them, or rather, let us test ourselves on whether this is or is not how we learned our letters. Consider first, do the syllables have an account while the elements are without account?
Perhaps.
That is certainly how it strikes me, too. At any rate, if someone were asked about the first syllable of Socrates, Theaetetus, tell me, what is so? What would you answer?
That it is sigma and omega.
And that is the account you have of the syllable.
It is.
Come then, give the account of the sigma in the same way.
But how could anyone state the elements of an element? Indeed, Socrates, the sigma is one of the voiceless letters, a mere noise like the tongue hissing, and beta again has neither tone nor noise, nor do most of the letters. So it fits very well to say they are without account, seeing that even the clearest of them, the seven vowels, have only sound and no account whatsoever.
On this point, then, my friend, we have got it right about knowledge.
So it seems.
But what about this? That the element is unknowable while the syllable is knowable. Have we shown that correctly?
It seems likely.
Come then, when we speak of the syllable, do we mean both elements? And if there are more than two, all of them, or some single form that has come to be once they are put together?
I think we mean all of them together.
Look at it with two, sigma and omega. Both together are the first syllable of my name. Whoever knows it knows both, doesn't he?
Of course.
So he knows the sigma and the omega.
Yes.
Well then, does he know each separately while being ignorant of both, and know both while knowing neither?
But that would be strange and unreasonable, Socrates.
And yet if it is necessary to know each, given that one is going to know both, then it is absolutely necessary for anyone who is ever going to know a syllable to know the elements beforehand. And so our fine account will have run off and escaped us.
Yes, and very suddenly, too.
That's because we are not guarding it well. Perhaps we should have said that the syllable is not the elements, but some single form that has come to be out of them, a single character of its own, distinct from the elements.
Quite so, and perhaps that is closer to the truth than the other way.
We must examine this, and not betray so unmanfully, so grand and solemn an account.
No, we must not.
Let it stand, then, as we are now saying. The syllable is a single form arising from each set of fitted together elements, alike in letters and in everything else.
Quite so.
Then it must have no parts.
Why is that?
Because wherever there are parts, the whole must necessarily be all the parts. Or do you also say that the whole, made up of the parts, is some single form distinct from all the parts?
I do.
And do you call the all and the whole the same thing or each different?
I have nothing clear to say, but since you tell me to answer boldly, I'll take the risk and say they're different.
Your boldness, Theaetetus, is correct. Whether your answer is too, we must examine.
Yes, we must.
Then, by this present account, the whole would differ from the all.
Yes.
Well, now do all things, and the all differ at all. Take it this way. When we say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and likewise if we say twice 3, or 3 times 2, or 4 and 2, or 3 and 2 and 1, are we in all these saying the same thing or something different?
The same.
Namely 6 and nothing else.
Nothing else.
So in each way of saying it, we have named all 6.
Yes.
And in saying all things, do we name nothing at all?
We must be naming something.
Nothing but the 6.
Nothing else.
So at least among things made up of number, the all and all things name the same thing.
So it appears.
Let us put it this way, then. The number belonging to a plot of land and the plot of land itself are the same, aren't they?
Yes.
And likewise the number of a stade and the stade.
Yes.
And indeed the number of an army and the army, and all such cases alike. For in each of them the whole number is the whole thing itself.
Yes.
And the number belonging to each of these, is it anything other than its parts?
Nothing else.
So whatever has parts would be made up of parts.
It appears so.
And it has been agreed that all the parts are the whole, since the whole number 2 will be the whole thing.
That's so.
Then the whole is not made up of parts, for if it were, being all the parts, it would be the all.
It doesn't seem so.
And is a part of anything else at all, except the whole?
Yes, of the all, at least.
You fight bravely indeed, Theaetetus, but when nothing is missing, isn't that very thing the all?
It must be.
And won't this same thing be the whole, that from which nothing anywhere stands apart? Whereas whatever a thing stands apart from is neither whole nor all, since it has become, from the same cause, no longer the same thing.
It seems to me now that all and whole differ in no way.
Well then, weren't we saying that wherever there are parts, the whole and the all will be all the parts?
Quite so.
So again, as I was trying to say just now, isn't it necessary, if the syllable is not the elements, that it does not have the elements as its parts, or else, being the same as them, it would be equally knowable as they are?
That's so.
And wasn't it to prevent that from happening that we made it something different from them?
Yes.
Well then, if the elements are not parts of the syllable, can you name anything else that is a part of the syllable, but not one of its elements?
Not at all, for if, Socrates, I were to grant it some parts of its own, it would be absurd to set aside the elements and go looking for other things.
So entirely, then, Theaetetus, by the present account, a syllable would be some single form without parts.
So it seems.
Do you remember, then, my friend, that a little earlier we accepted it, thinking it well said, that there is no account of the primary things out of which everything else is composed, because each of them, taken by itself, is uncompounded, and it isn't even right to speak of being concerning it, or even the word this, as something said in addition and foreign to it, and that this very reason made it without account and unknowable.
I remember.
Well, is there any other reason for its being single in form and without parts than this very one? I for one see none other.
No, indeed, none appears.
Then the syllable has fallen into the same case as the element, if it truly has no parts and is a single form.
Entirely so.
If then the syllable is many elements in some whole, and these are its parts, then the syllables are knowable and expressible just as much as the elements, since all the parts turned out to be the same as the whole.
Quite true.
But if it is one thing, without parts, then the syllable is equally without account and unknowable as the element, for the same reasoning will make them both so.
I can't say otherwise.
So we must not accept it, then, from anyone who says that the syllable is knowable and expressible, while the element is the opposite.
No, we must not, if we are persuaded by the argument.
But what again? Wouldn't you rather welcome the opposite claim, judging from what you yourself know from learning your letters?
What claim is that?
That in learning, you did nothing else but try to distinguish the elements, both by sight and by hearing, each one on its own, so that their order in speech and in writing wouldn't confuse you.
What you say is perfectly true.
And in the music school, wasn't full mastery just this, being able to follow each note and tell which string it belonged to, the very things everyone would agree are the elements of music?
Nothing else.
So then, going by the elements and syllables we ourselves have experience of, if we are to draw a conclusion from these to the rest, we would say that the class of elements affords a far clearer and more authoritative knowledge than the syllable does, for grasping any subject fully. And if anyone says that the syllable is knowable but the element unknowable by nature, we will take him to be joking, whether he means to or not.
Quite so.
But other proofs of this could still be found, I think. Still, let us not lose sight, on account of these, of the question before us. Namely, what in the world is meant by saying that knowledge is most complete when true judgment is joined by an account?
Yes, we must look into that.
Come then, what can the account possibly mean for us? For it seems to me to be one of three things.
Which three?
The first would be making one's own thought plain through speech, by means of verbs and nouns, imprinting one's judgment, as into a mirror or water, onto the stream that flows through the mouth. Doesn't something of that sort seem to you to be an account?
It does to me. At any rate, we say that whoever does this is giving an account.
And isn't this, at least, something everyone is capable of doing sooner or later, showing what he thinks about anything, unless he's been mute or deaf from birth? And so everyone who holds any correct judgment at all will turn out to have it along with an account, and correct judgment apart from knowledge will nowhere still occur.
True.
Let's not be too quick to convict the person who declared that knowledge is what we're now considering of saying nothing at all. Maybe what he meant wasn't that, but that when asked what any given thing is, one should be able to answer by breaking it down into its elements for the questioner.
What sort of thing do you mean, Socrates?
The sort of thing Hesiod says about a wagon, that it has 100 timbers. I couldn't list them, and I don't think you could either. We'd be satisfied if asked what a wagon is to be able to say, wheels, axle, body, rails, yoke.
Quite so.
But he might think we were being ridiculous, the way someone would be ridiculous if asked to spell your name and answered letter by letter. We'd be forming a correct judgment and saying what we say correctly, but thinking we were being literate, and that we possessed and could state the literate account of the name Theaetetus, when in fact one can't speak with real knowledge about anything until one has gone through it element by element together with true judgment, as was said somewhere earlier.